We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomchik with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning. He
snowed in. Iced in, I guess.
Yeah. Didn't help that we packed all that snow around his front door.
Speak for yourself, Mike.
Know. Idle hands. All right, so let's plenty to cover still, regardless. Sticking with that theme of snow.
Snow and ice, yeah. And ice. I want to talk a little bit about the difference in the city's snow and ice response this time around versus the last time we had a big major snowstorm. It was actually pretty good this time, and I just want to go over some of the differences. This time around, Mayor Mike McGinn was actually in town versus the last time we had a snowstorm when our former mayor, Greg Nichols, was on vacation in warmer climes. Nobody also this time around, nobody in the city council came out of their house, stood around in the street and said, oh, my street looks good. I think people should go ahead and drive into work, which is what happened last time when Gene Godden, the city council president, was in charge. This time also, the city focused on clearing the main arterials for buses so that people who had to travel and couldn't get around by car could get around still, and that the folks who could get around by car or by truck or whatever could actually drive on some main arterials, whereas the last time you had a lot of main arterials that were never saw a plow, never saw sand or salt or anything. So that was actually, I think, a lot better. And, of course, this time the city actually told people not to drive on Wednesday and Thursday. That's a big difference from last time. So this time around, a lot of people were complaining about the weather itself and about weather forecasters who got it a little bit wrong. And, you know, that's really the way it should be. You should be complaining about Mother Nature versus complaining about the city not being prepared for snow and ice. And that really, I don't think that really was a problem this time. Of course, the cost of the city's snow and ice response was about $700,000. And that gives you an idea of why some politicians may not have prepared in the past, because setting aside, you know, $1 million or more in order to deal with snow and ice when many years we don't even get snowfall like last winter doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, especially when we're looking at budget cuts. Mayor McGinn has upped the weather response budget this year to $1.4 million, so we'll be ready in case there's another storm just like the one we had. But hopefully we won't get another one.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, the plastic bags.
Yeah, this week the anti-plastic bag ban petition failed to get enough signatures to make it to the ballot in August. They needed 16,000, but they only collected about 2,000 to 3,000. In December, just to remind folks, in December the city council passed a ban on plastic checkout bags, and as part of that ban, they require paper bags to be at least 40% recycled content, and they've given retailers permission to charge a nickel a bag for people who ask for paper bags for their groceries and for their other items. That's to encourage people to use reusable bags whenever possible. Now, the state legislature is also working on a bill that would ban plastic bags statewide. Now, the state ban, however, unlike the city ban, is probably going to run up against opposition from the plastics industry. Now, the plastics industry has done their best to deal with statewide bans. They defeated a statewide ban in California and also one in Oregon. And if the legislature passes or tries to pass one, the plastics industry may come out with an initiative to try to repeal it.
So, yeah, they're pretty pretty powerful in that respect. So
they are, yeah. With all that extra money.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, the Department of Justice.
Yeah, the DOJ said this week that they were not going to file charges against former Seattle Police Department officer Ian Burke in the shooting of John T. Williams, the Native American woodcarver who was shot in the summer of 2010 as he was crossing the street. He was wearing headphones at the time, and he had a small carving knife and a piece of wood in his hand. He was carving as he was walking down the street listening to music. Officer Ian Burke was in his car, stopped at a light. He saw Burke, got out of his car, yelled at him, drew his gun, and shot him four times. The Department of Justice, they said that, quote, the evidence was insufficient beyond a reasonable doubt that Burke acted willfully and with a deliberate and specific intent to do something the law forbids. Now, that's a really high bar to set trying to prove an officer's intent versus his actions, and to prove his intent beyond a doubt kind of makes you ask the question, how can anybody really do that, prove someone's intent beyond a doubt, unless you can actually get inside their head? It puts up a really high bar and essentially says that police are above the law in terms of their actual actions, that unless we can prove we know what they were thinking at the time, we can't bring any case or any lawsuit against them. Now, I just want to remind people that a Seattle Police Department internal review found that Burke had violated the department's policy, tactics, and training. So the Seattle Police Department could at least rule on his actions if the Department of Justice can't.
But we're not expecting any movement there, are we?
No, we're not expecting any movement anytime soon on that.
All right. Well, moving on down to Olympia and a lot of legislators working there.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting bills in the legislature. I just want to talk about a few of them. One of them is a bill to create a Washington State Bank, and it's got legs, and it's moving through both the House and the Senate. Now, that House bill number, if you want to contact your House representatives, is HB 2434, and the Senate bill number is SB 6310, if you want to contact your state senator in order to urge them to vote for the Washington Investment Trust, which would be a state bank that the state can do business with and that could take depositors' cash and turn around and make loans locally instead of us having to do it through these big national and international banks.
Yeah, that we just had a couple guests on at 7:30 talking about that.
Excellent.
And
And I want to talk about a few other bills, too.
Okay.
One is out there to require classified advertising companies to verify the age of escorts who place ads. This is in response to Backpages.com. It's an online website owned by Village Voice Media, which also owns the Seattle Weekly. The Seattle Police Department claims that Backpages.com has been taking ads from underage prostitutes and that they've busted a number of underage prostitutes and their pimps who've used Backpages.com. Of course, underage prostitution is illegal. It's a federal crime. The stranger, in the meantime, if you want to contrast to how Backpages.com operates, the stranger, on the other hand, says that they have always asked for ID to prove the age of people who place ads in their personal sections. And they basically said, you know, they don't understand why Backpages.com can't do that. Of course, Backpages.com is a national clearinghouse, so they would have to hire people in various locales in order to check IDs to do that, and that would be more expensive than they want to, you know, pay. The Village Voice Media says that it will fight the bill as a violation of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, which exempts online sites from being liable for the speech of unaffiliated parties. But I also want to point out that Backpages.com isn't just your ordinary website that has some links to other off-site websites that might have objectionable content to them, and that these ads are not, for example, like readers commenting on a story on the website or something. These ads are content that's posted by Backpages.com, and they have a duty to deal with any content that breaks federal or state law, and they're really not doing that duty. So I think the legislature ought to go ahead and push for this bill to pass.
So they have the resources to challenge this in court, but they don't apparently have the resources to be able to do the ID check?
Yeah, apparently. Huh. And I'm not buying it.
Okay.
Another bill that I want to talk about, too, is a bill. It's a medical marijuana bill. It would allow local governments to regulate nonprofit patient cooperatives that could grow up to 99 plants per cooperative. They would be prohibited in counties with less than 200,000 people. So most rural areas wouldn't be able to have them unless those particular counties or the towns within them passed local ordinances allowing a patient cooperative to form The cooperatives would be allowed in counties with more than 200,000 people unless those counties or localities opt out by passing an ordinance prohibiting them. Also, the bill would include a voluntary registry for patients, which is controversial. Some people think that it's great to have a voluntary registry for patients because they want there to be a record somewhere that they officially are allowed to have medical marijuana. Other people say that, no, this is just something the feds could come in and seize and use to prosecute people. So the bill is got some supporters and some detractors just on the registry issue. But I just want to point out, too, that the co-op structure might, depending, of course, on how the bill is worded, I haven't actually read the bill yet, but it may also address concerns that some people have that medical marijuana stores might become like big box stores, extremely commercial and extremely profitable for whoever is running them. And that the cooperative structure could address that issue and make it more of something, more responsive to the customers, let's just say that, than to people trying to make a profit off of marijuana.
I'm just trying to picture like the PCC of medical marijuana. It's an intriguing idea.
Yeah.
As compared to Costco, if they got their, you know, hands on this.
Yeah, as compared to Costco or someone like that.
All right.
And then finally, I want to talk briefly about a bill that would require ballot initiatives to include a funding source if the ballot initiative would cost the state or localities more than $5 million to implement. First of all, this would put a serious crimp in the kinds of citizen initiatives that we would see on the ballot. You could have a citizen initiative out there that people really support and could get enough signatures to go to the state, but if the state rules that it would cost over $5 million, and of course they would be the ones to decide, it wouldn't be any outside expert that would make that decision, and it doesn't include a funding source, then it would never make it to the ballot, even though it got all of the signatures that it needed to. I also want to kind of point out that in order for this bill to pass the state legislature, it would require a two-thirds majority vote in the state legislature, and then it would have to go to a public vote and pass a public vote as well in order to become law. Now, I just kind of want to ask, why is the state legislature wasting its time on this bill that would require funding sources attached to ballot initiatives when it hasn't got a hope in hell of passing, when all they would need is a two-thirds majority vote in order to pass tax reform or to close some tax loopholes? They should really be working on revenue increasing measures instead of working on these sort of sideline issues that really is a consolidation of power for the state legislature and an attempt to get rid of public participation in the political process.
All right. Anything else on bills coming out of Olympia?
No, that's it for today. We'll probably talk a lot in the coming weeks, though.
Okay. Then that moves us on to national, starting with Mitt Romney and his taxes.
Yeah, there was a lot of talk on the mainstream news this week and on, you know, in the pundits' shows and so forth on Mitt Romney's tax rate. How much in taxes did he pay? When's he going to release his tax returns? And finally, Romney came out and said, oh, I pay around a 15% tax rate, you know, which is far, far below the upper tax rate for high income individuals. Now, don't be fooled. He's not a poor guy. His fortune is estimated to be about $250 million, which puts him way up there above most of the presidential candidates that we've seen in the past 200 or so years. He also got flack this week from other Republicans, and I thought this was kind of funny that other Republicans would point at him and say, look, he worked as a CEO in a private equity firm, and private equity firms buy up companies and lay people off. He's a job killer, not a job creator, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's kind of ironic given that the Republican Party usually is the major recipient of money from CEOs and other folks who run private equity firms. So I'd be kind of interested to see if private equity firms and much of Wall Street will back off from supporting the Republican Party, since the Republican Party since its candidates are so happy to attack Wall Street. Now, I also want to point out, too, that Mitt Romney said that his tax rate was around 15%. Now, that's less than half what his wealthy father paid. His tax rate was 37%. It's also less than Mitt Romney would have paid 10 years ago. He would have paid 25% or around there on his income. And it's a lot less than he would have paid 15 years ago. During the Clinton years, he would have paid about 29% or higher on his income taxes. I also want to point out, too, that 15 years ago, when taxes on the rich were much higher during the early part of Bill Clinton's presidency, the economy was doing much, much, much better than it's doing right now. There was no federal deficit. We had a federal surplus. During the first Clinton term, the United States gained about 11.5 million jobs, which is far better than we did during the whole length of George W. Bush's presidency. So I just want to point that out, because there are a lot of people out there who say when you raise taxes on the rich, you're killing the economy. I think it's really the reverse. When you raise taxes on the rich, you're giving the economy a big boost. And I think it would be hard to argue against that. Now, did you have a question, Mike?
Go ahead. I was just going to say, I thought I saw something this week about Mitt Romney having a bunch of his investments in offshore.
Yes, accounts. Yes, uh-huh. In addition to getting flack for being the CEO of Bain Capital, which he still has much of his funds invested in, has set up a whole bunch of offshore investment partnerships in places like the Cayman Islands. Well, there's no reason to set up an investment partnership outside of the United States unless you are going to dodge taxes. That's the main reason. So when Mitt Romney says, oh, no, or his advisors say, oh, no, he didn't invest in those funds in order to avoid U.S. income tax, they're not telling you the truth. He's invested in those partnerships precisely to avoid U.S. income taxes. He's got at least 25, as far as we know, at least $25 million invested in offshore investment funds. And I also want to point out, too, that the last couple of presidential candidates, you know, Barack Obama, even Kaine, they came out and said, when we're president, we're going to do something about those tax dodgers, those rich people who put their money in offshore investments. We haven't heard that coming from Mitt Romney, because, of course, he's one of those investors. So I find that very interesting.
I thought the new head of staff at the White House also worked at Bain Capital.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's a revolving door. The folks who are economic advisors to President Obama are going to be people who are very, very familiar with how the financial industry works. And, of course, they will take advantage of these kinds of tax, tax preference, tax preference investments, those things that help you avoid paying taxes. You know, if you've got the money, you do it. And that's what they're doing. And also, too, when Romney says, oh, I have no idea if when I worked during Bain Capital did any of those terrible things that they say it did. Well, in fact, Bain Capital was a leveraged buyout, or is a leveraged buyout firm. It's the kind of company that would go in and buy up a company that's not doing so well and then lay off a whole bunch of people. In other words, get rid of the excess is what they call it. Lay off a whole bunch of people, turn the company around so that it makes massive profits for the shareholders, often taking out huge loans having the company take out huge loans so that they can pay even more money to the investors. And then when the company takes a downturn, ditching it, letting it go through bankruptcy. And in some cases, what leverage buyout firms do is once they've run the company into the ground, it's gone through bankruptcy, sometimes they buy it up again and start the whole process all over. So this is what leverage buyout firms do. And this is what companies like Bain Capital do. So Gingrich was right. They are job killers, in essence. They are not job creators. And that's precisely not the point. The point is they make a lot of money for their investors.
Well, there's some words you don't hear on this segment much. Gingrich was right.
Well, that's why I said I find it ironic. You've got Republican candidates out there kind of exposing the seamy underbelly of Wall Street. Does that mean Wall Street's going to stop contributing to the Republican Party? I would like to say yes, but we'll just have to wait and see.
They're just going to cut back on some of their cocktails.
Yeah, or we may see that Gingrich doesn't make it through the South Carolina primary. You know, you just never know. Not that I'm a Gingrich supporter. I'm really not. But
all right. About 10 minutes left, continuing with national and Vermont.
Yeah, a federal judge ruled this week that the state of Vermont could not close a nuclear power plant in its state. The 40-year-old Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, which is now owned by Entergy, got a 20-year extension of its license from the federal government, from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. But when Entergy was bought, when they bought Vermont Yankee in 2002, Entergy entered into a memorandum of agreement with the state of Vermont that said that in order to get an extension on its 40-year operating license, it would need more than just to get the extension of its license from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It would also need to get a certificate of public good from the state of Vermont. Since 2002, Vermont Yankee has had a number of safety issues going on. In 2007, one of its cooling towers collapsed because of untreated wood rot, which I think probably tells you how well Entergy has been maintaining the plant. Also, executives running the Vermont Yankee plant claimed that the plant had no underground pipes at all, when in fact they did have underground pipes, and those underground pipes in that time period leaked radioactive material. So they were caught with kind of their finger in the cookie jar, making money but not maintaining the plant the way they should. Vermont Yankee, of course, is also the exact same design as the number one reactor at Fukushima. So, of course, the state legislature in Vermont is really concerned that if this 40-year-old power plant gets a 20-year extension, that they're going to see even more and even worse safety problems. So, of course, the legislature tried to pass a bill to deny the certificate of public good to Vermont Yankee, but Entergy sued, and a federal judge, J. Gavin Murtha, blocked the state of Vermont from closing down Vermont Yankee. I just want to point out, too, that before 2002, when Entergy bought Vermont Yankee, Vermont Yankee was owned by a group of public utilities in the state of Vermont. So this is the peril of privatizing your public utilities, that it may come down the down the road later to come back to bite you. So.
All right. Well, that takes us out of national into international.
Yeah,
starting with Greece.
Some news from Europe. It hasn't been big in the press lately, but Greece is hovering on a knife's edge right now. They need to pass. They need to tie up some negotiations that they're going through with private investors, holders of their government bonds, in order to get them to take a write down of about 50% on their bonds and to pay lower interest rates on new bonds that they would issue in place of those old bonds. Well, hedge funds in particular, but other private investors are holding off. They don't want to agree to that, to the terms of the negotiation. But if the negotiations are not tied up and Greece can't get some kind of an agreement in place, they may lose out on a crucial 30 billion euro payment that they need to get from the European Central Bank and the IMF and the European Union in order to help tide them over so that they can pay their bills. So they're kind of on a knife's edge. They're actually having their feet being held to the fire by these private investment funds and hedge funds. And it's sort of a hostage situation. Many of these huge investors, they really don't want to do a voluntary write-down. They want to they have every incentive to force the government of Greece to go into default so that they can collect on the credit default swaps, the insurance that they've bought in case their bonds are proved worthless. If Greece goes into a default, they have a much greater chance of collecting on their credit default swaps, which I think once again proves that these derivatives need to be regulated, and we need to be asking, are some of them helpful or more harmful?
And these credit default swaps, what would they equate to Is there physical property that they get for that or what?
Yeah, they get cash payments. If their bonds are proved worthless, then the insurance company, whoever wrote the credit default swap and sold it to them, would give them the money, the value of the bond, essentially. They would get the full value instead of just the 50% that they would get if they voluntarily agreed to write down with Greece.
So is the insurance company getting involved with this too? Are they lobbying the Greek government?
I have no idea. They're not a party to the negotiations, though. The private investors, the people who actually hold the bonds, those guys are. And a lot of those guys own these credit default swaps that they've taken out with insurance companies. Those folks, the private investors, they're the ones sitting down at the table and dragging their feet on the agreement.
Okay.
Now, I also want to point out, too, that Greece's debt has been about 140% of their GDP, which is, you know, obviously unsustainable. But after this agreement is met, even, you know, if they actually get the negotiations done and Greece gets what they want, it still would not provide very much debt relief for them. Their debt would go from 140% of gross domestic product down to about 120% of their GDP. So even though they're going through these arduous negotiations and Greece has been going through something like 4 or 5 years of economic austerity measures, their debt is completely unsustainable. So I just want to kind of point out, too, that maybe they ought to go through default. Of course, there are punishments when you go through default. Argentina went through a default, and they still can't. Even almost a decade afterwards, they still can't get decent loans on the public market. They can't sell their bonds.
All right. Let's move on to the final item, Afghanistan.
Yeah, there was a report that the New York Times did. They got hold of a classified report on U.S. and Afghan troop relations in Afghanistan. And the report was specifically done, the study was specifically done, it's a classified study, but it was specifically done to address the problem of Afghan troops turning on their U.S. trainers and killing them, which has been happening with much more frequency in Afghanistan, particularly in the last 2 years, since about October of 2009. It's gotten very bad. The U.S. command and NATO command have been routinely saying that, oh, it's elements of the Taliban that have infiltrated the Afghan military. That's how bad it is here. We have to stay here. We have to continue the fight, et cetera, et cetera. But this classified report makes it pretty clear that the Taliban have nothing to do with it. I'm just going to read a quote from the report. Quote, lethal altercations are clearly not rare or isolated. They reflect a rapidly growing systemic homicide threat, a magnitude of which may be unprecedented between allies in modern military history. That's a quote from the report. And the report goes on to say that it has very little to do with the Taliban. What it has to do with is a very deep contempt that both sides have for each other. And it quotes some Afghan soldiers that they interviewed, and they interviewed a lot of them, saying that, well, the Americans are arrogant. When one of their troops die or is killed in battle, they take it out on the civilian population, et cetera. And then they quote the Americans as saying, well, the Afghan troops are lazy, they're drug addicts, they don't learn what we teach them, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds an awful lot to me. And of course, the report comes down to saying, well, it's a culture clash. Well, maybe it's a culture clash, but I want to ask, is it really a clash of cultures or is it a reaction to invaders by the occupied? And I would argue that that's probably much more what it is, and that it is long past time when NATO and the U.S. should have left Afghanistan.
All right. Events?
Yeah, one event today. From noon to 4 p.m. at Westlake, it's Get the Money Out of Politics, Remove Corporate Personhood. They'll have a rally at noon and then a march at 2 p.m. to City Hall. So the rally's at Westlake at noon and then 2 p.m. march to City Hall.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Maria Tomchuk with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
People can find Eat the State online at www.eatthestate.org.